The U.S. locked away hundreds of thousands of people for decades with conditions like Down syndrome and autism in state-run institutions.
The doctor had warned me that it would be bad. It was horrible.
Neglect and abuse could run rampant.
Their life is just hours and hours of endless nothing to do, no one to talk to, no expectations, just an endless life of misery and filth.
Then, on June 22nd, 1999...
The opinion of the court in number 98536, Olmstead versus LC, will be announced by Justice Ginsburg.
The Supreme Court issued the Olmstead ruling and slammed the door on that dark era in American history.
Unjustified institutionalization of persons with mental disabilities, we hold, qualifies as discrimination by reason of a disability within the compass of the ADA's Title II.
This decision opened up the chance for people with disabilities to live more freely and fully. But more than two decades later, physicians, hospitals, and insurers often make it difficult to live that life. Today, what it will take for the nation to get closer to the full promise of Olmstead and one doctor's work to forge a better path. From the studio at the Leonard Davis Institute at the University of Pennsylvania, I'm Dan Gorenstein. This is Trade-Offs. Clarissa Kripke began her career in 1999, the year the Supreme Court issued Olmstead. She liked that anyone could walk into her office as a family doc at the University of California, San Francisco.
We take care of people from birth to death. We accept everybody, and we do our best.
But to this day, 25 years later, Clarissa still believes she failed to do her best with one of her first patients, a woman we're calling Paula, to protect her privacy.
She had a lot of skills. She walked, she talked, she checked her own blood sugars.
Paula had diabetes and an intellectual disability. She lived in a small group home outside San Francisco and was having trouble. One day, Paula threw a chair at one of the group home staff.
They sent her to the hospital for a psychiatric admission. They refused to take her home. They said, we don't want her back.
Most group home workers, doctors, nurses, and insurers were just learning to treat adults with disabilities who were leaving institutions, and it was tough. A 2003 survey showed that a majority of folks felt disrespected by their providers. Other research showed people were over-medicated and misdiagnosed. Clarissa says it could all feel overwhelming.
People were just showing up in doctor's offices in ones and twos and threes. But since there wasn't really a way to take on a cohort of patients and make it your day job to really get good at it, we didn't.
Paula landed in a new group home. Clarissa picked up a call several months later saying that Paula was doing great. Diabetes under control. No behavioral issues. Clarissa said, bring her in.
She comes into my office, wheeled in a wheelchair, not speaking. And anybody who had ever met her before would know something dramatic had happened.
A total metamorphosis.
She died 2 weeks later.
Paula and her story have stuck with Clarissa. So many woulda, coulda, shouldas. Clarissa, after the fact, realized Paula acting out was her trying to express pain, and she had let 8 weeks go without checking in on her patient. But this was also a chance to learn.
It's important to me that if I make a mistake, that I honor the memory of my patient by not making the same mistake myself again, and by teaching others how to avoid the same mistakes.
This health system failure fuels Clarissa, and it infuriates her too. For all the hard-fought progress she's made professionally, designing a first-of-its-kind program, Clarissa thinks outcomes like Paula's are as likely to happen today as they were back then.
There's a tenet in the disability rights movement that if you aren't ashamed of what you were doing 10 years ago, then you're not doing something right.
Conditions have shifted for the 2 million U.S. adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities since the Olmstead ruling and Paula's death. The number of people in large state-run facilities has plummeted to fewer than 20,000. Most now live with family, on their own, or in small group homes. But the 30 sources we spoke to for this story, including providers, researchers, people with disabilities, and federal officials, all say the healthcare system is struggling to meet the needs of this population. University of Chicago researcher Harold Pollack.
People with intellectual disabilities live full human lives and need to be treated, respected, addressed the same way that we do every other patient who shows up at the doctor. And we are a long way from that.
There's little high-quality data on this population, but the numbers we do have paint a troubling picture. Patients are less likely to get preventative care, like dental exams and mammograms, and they're more likely to take trips to the ER, trips that are avoidable. Just 4 in 10 doctors say they feel, quote, very confident in providing the same quality of care to people with a disability as those without one. That's all despite Medicaid spending north of $40 billion a year to help this group thrive outside of institutions. Top it all off, we've seen people's civil rights violated. Providers denying patients interpreters, states locking people in jails and psych wards instead of serving them in the community. In the days immediately following Paula's death, a question gnawed at Clarissa.
Can we do better than this?
Clarissa felt she had 2 very compelling reasons to rise to her own call.
It's frustrating, not only as a physician, to not be able to provide the care that I feel my patients need and deserve, but it's a personal issue too, because I have a kid who needs that care and I can't access it even for my own kid.
H-I-M-R-A-C-H-E-L. Hi, I'm Rachel.
In 2006, Clarissa's daughter, Rachel, who points 2 letters on a piece of paper to communicate, was diagnosed with autism.
A-U-G-H-T-E-R. I'm Dr. Kripke's daughter.
Clarissa had all the motivation she needed, just no roadmap. But she did know what didn't work.
When people come into my office, I can't get them on the exam table. I can't get a wait. I only have 15-minute appointments.
Making it up as she went along, Clarissa decided to experiment, ditch the quickie appointments and cramped exam rooms, and light out to group homes where her patients lived. These house calls, Clarissa learned, allowed her to more fully take in the person and ask better questions.
How do you want to spend your day? Where do you want to go? What do you want to do?
The kinds of questions most doctors failed to ask her daughter, Rachel. And truthfully, the kinds of questions Clarissa wished she had asked Paula. But to realize her grand ambition, basically turning her practice inside out, Clarissa knew she'd need to get paid in new ways and find partners, insurers, and providers who shared her vision.
That everyone was going to have all the healthcare services they need to maximize their potential.
We go inside the model Clarissa and the team built, the impact it's had, and meet one of the people it's helped after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Shannon Crane from the Trade-Offs audience team. We're trying a new way to let you, our listeners, shape our reporting. If you've had a firsthand experience, good or bad, with how our healthcare system treats people with intellectual or developmental disabilities, we want to hear about it. Share your story by leaving us a voicemail at 215-703-8255. Again, the number is 215-703-8255. Or visit tradeoffs.org/disability for more ways to get in touch. Thanks.
Welcome back. Nearly 25 years ago, the Supreme Court cemented the rights of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities to live more freely. Now that more adults live in the community, though, data suggests that healthcare system is struggling to meet their needs. The work of Dr. Clarissa Kripke in the San Francisco Bay Area is an exception. She's teamed up with a health insurer, local agencies, and advocates to help people live healthier, more independent lives.
People still today believe that there are some people who need to be in institutions because their needs are too great. That's just not true. We've proved that even people with the most complex needs can be served in the community.
Over the last 15 years, Clarissa and this group have chiseled out a picture of what's possible. Care that focuses on people's medical and social needs, advocating for nicer homes with more staffing, and pushing to get their hands on more research to understand how to best care for adults who are living longer than ever before. Formally, Clarissa calls this the CART model, which stands for Clinical Services, Advocacy, Research, and Training. But really, she says, it's just common sense.
Healthcare is about more than being free from illness, that wellness is about being able to make your best contribution, being able to share your gifts, to vote, to work.
We wanted to see this model in action, so we asked senior producer Leslie Walker to spend some time with Clarissa and her patients.
Clarissa and I meet on a quiet suburban street. It's about 40 minutes south of San Francisco in Redwood City. We walk into a nice house with blue shingles, white trim. Five people live here, all have disabilities and serious 24/7 medical needs. Clarissa, wearing a dress, Lands End, she jokes, because she's practical like that, unpacks her black roller bag and pulls out the beating heart of her mobile clinic, her laptop.
Up on the dining room table.
She logs on and gets right to work typing out her prescription. I look around. A fish tank's gurgling. There's a sliding door opening to a big tree-lined backyard. Part of the early CART model work, Clarissa tells me, was advising the state of California on how to build new homes just like this one.
Open layout where you have good sight lines and the wider doors.
We head down the hall to a pair of private rooms and poke our heads into the first door on the left.
Knock, knock. Yes. So Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
Life-sized cutouts of professional wrestlers decorate the room of Kevin Carlson.
I'm a junkie.
The 62-year-old who sports a graying buzz cut and is wearing a Giants baseball jersey is also clearly a wrestling junkie. Kevin was born with cerebral palsy. His arms and legs are pretty much locked. The ventilator helps him breathe. Turns out, Kevin loves telling some truly brutal jokes. Like, what do you get when you cross a rhino with an elephant? Kevin asks me and a couple of nurses.
Hell if I know.
Hell if I know, Kevin says, smiling with his entire face.
Kevin!
Kevin relishes the groans. He's a ham, for sure. But you can also feel he just enjoys connecting with people. As Clarissa catches up with a nurse, Kevin tells me he's happy, doing pretty well, all things considered. When he first arrived here, he weighed just 70 pounds.
How much are you now?
Like, 111.
111, he says proudly. Clarissa's grown her practice from a handful of people in just three group homes to patients in 25 homes across four counties. And she's learned a valuable lesson. Keep it under 100 folks.
When I started to write contracts for more and more homes, I realized that I needed a contract that reflected the amount of time it took.
Clarissa treats less than 1/10 as many patients as a typical primary care doc. She's tracked her time, realized that for every hour of face-to-face patient care, she spends another 6 on what she calls the hidden work, dealing with insurers and government agencies, coordinating with nurses, nutritionists, social workers, family members. So these days, she only agrees to contracts that actually give her the time and the money to do what she's got to do.
Secure texting at any time of day. I will do home visits. I will go to the hospital. I will go to their day program to see what's going on.
A flat $500 fee per patient per month covers Clarissa's salary, travel, tech, plus some admin support. She visits her patients in their homes at least once every 3 months. Clarissa says staff help keep costs down and quality high by paying close attention and advocating for residents. Nurse Marjorie Ongpauko tells me Clarissa relies on the entire team to be her eyes and ears.
She's always, you know, she's always asking, what do you think, Marge? What do you think? You know, what are your thoughts? In the beginning, I was kind of like, is this a quiz? But it's actually not, right?
Here's a great example of what advocacy looks like in real time. Donna Valencia, who runs the group home where Kevin lives, says staff noticed Kevin's ventilator making it tough to talk.
You know, like, it's like talking with a pillow over you.
Donna and Clarissa spent weeks lobbying Kevin's insurer to greenlight a valve that would make it easier for him to speak. He debuted it on the day of my visit, and we talked for close to 30 minutes about everything from the heavy metal band Iron Maiden to his late wife, who passed away 9 years ago.
He was a Leo. Leo. Stubborn.
She was a Leo. Stubborn, he said. The work to get Kevin a valve captures the CART model's chief aim, help the whole person. And that's what struck me after spending a few days with Clarissa. She and the nurses spend a ton of time thinking about the needs of their patients as people, the places they want to go, the relationships they want to have, and the schedules they want to keep. Kevin used to live with help in his own place until a serious infection landed him in the hospital a few years back. What Kevin wants is a taste of what he had.
Do you miss the life that you had before?
Yes.
Yes, Kevin says, his eyes watering a little.
Why is that making you emotional?
Hard to say.
Is there something you did when you lived independently that you miss doing now that you're here?
They go on the cuff, on the cuff, on the fly.
Doing stuff off the cuff, doing stuff on the fly, he says. Going to heavy metal shows, getting high at those shows. So last fall, when some of Kevin's favorite pro wrestlers were coming to town, staff thought, what a perfect chance to give Kevin a taste of that old life.
San Jose, welcome to Monday Night Raw!
15,000 rabid fans packed the SAP Center in downtown San Jose. From a front row seat, Kevin's eyes lock on the ring. My eyes fix on Eric, a respiratory therapist, and Josh, a nurse, who buzz around Kevin. They suction his lungs to help him breathe, check his oxygen, his catheter, all while a bunch of dudes pound beer and boo a bearded man dressed as a giant Viking. Pretty soon, the crowd starts to roar.
Oh, yeah!
Kevin's eyes light up, and one of his favorite wrestlers enters the ring. Seth freaking Rollins. About 2 hours into this 3-hour spandex extravaganza, Kevin's getting tired. It's getting harder for him to breathe. Eric calls it. It's time to go home. Kevin, still amped, recaps the highlights with Josh as we head to the van.
I can't believe they do like backflips off of the top rope. Like, oh my gosh, he's got 330 pounds just like soaring through the air. Oh, it's crazy. So much better in person, huh?
This is Clarissa's model in action. Eric and Josh working hard to support Kevin. Kevin's health taken a bit of a hit. He was exhausted for a week after the match. Clarissa says this is what it takes for healthcare to do better by people with disabilities. The money and effort to staff a trip like this. The conviction that sometimes physical health takes a second seat to joy. All so Kevin can live more the life he wants.
It's professionally invigorating, personally invigorating, and meaningful, deeply meaningful work.
We're back with senior producer Leslie Walker talking about what it would take to scale this type of work nationwide after the break.
Hey, it's Shannon Crane from the Trade-Offs audience team. We're trying a new way to let you, our listeners, shape our reporting. If you've had a firsthand experience, good or bad, with how our healthcare system treats people with intellectual or developmental disabilities, we want to hear about it. Share your story by leaving us a voicemail at 215-703-8255. Again, the number is 215-703-8255. Or visit tradeoffs.org/disability for more ways to get in touch. Thanks.
Welcome back. Clarissa Kripke's model, the CART program, shows us what care for people with some of the most complex medical needs looks like in a small corner of our country's healthcare system. But what about for the other 2 million adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities? To talk about the national landscape, let's bring back senior producer Leslie Walker. Hey, Leslie.
Hey, Dan.
So look, your field report about Kevin Carlson, nice job, by the way, and that wrestling match captured what prioritizing the needs of the patient looks like, right? And I was blown away by the resources that that must have taken.
Totally. I mean, the tickets, the van, the extra oxygen and ventilator batteries, the intensive care from Josh and Eric, all just to get Kevin out of the house for a few hours.
And like, how many other people in the country with disabilities out there, Leslie, have access to those sorts of resources?
It's, of course, hard to know for sure, but Medicaid does spend more than $40 billion a year on community care, stuff like rehab after leaving the hospital, rides to work, help making meals. But what people get depends a lot on where they live.
You mean because of Medicaid, right? The state-run program, so each state's going to have sort of a different deal?
Exactly. And in some states, it's pretty bad. There are some crazy wait lists out there. Like Florida, for example, has more than 70,000 folks waiting. South Carolina, more than 40,000. All people going without services they say they need to live in the community. And the types of folks we're talking about in this story, Dan, they're waiting 4 years on average.
That's amazing. So on the one hand, you've got a situation like Kevin's, right? But on the other, you've got folks going years without help for things like shopping for groceries or managing their meds.
Yeah. And some research, Dan, suggests those shortfalls hit Black and Hispanic people harder. I talked to Allison Barkoff, who heads up all things community living over at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She said if we're going to have more people with disabilities living independently, basically more wrestling matches, more money has got to be spent.
The biggest barrier to translating the promise of Olmstead into reality is funding. We need more funding to expand services to make sure everybody has the opportunity to live real included lives in the community.
Fine, Leslie, but I can hear state lawmakers from here talking about tough budget realities. In fact, Indiana is moving to cut funding for families with disabilities. What's the sell to lawmakers? Can any of these services actually save money?
So research shows for really sick people like Kevin, his care is cheaper living in a group home than, let's say, a nursing home. But for people with fewer medical needs, states would need to spend more money on housing, on schools, to make all that stuff more inclusive. And another thing, Dan, there's just nowhere near enough workers around to help people like Kevin shower, dress, and eat every day. Again, here's Allison Barkoff.
Because of low wages and a lack of respect, we are at a point where we have the vast majority of providers who are turning down referrals and even closing services because of the direct care workforce crisis.
Let me say that again, Dan. Social service providers who care for this population are turning people away, turning down business because they lack enough staff. We're talking about close to 8 million vacant jobs expected over this decade.
Okay. You've given me an answer, Leslie, to what care looks like for many of the 2 million people who are not Dr. Clarissa Kripke's patients. Wait lists, budget cuts, staffing shortages. That is a world away from Kevin's experience.
It is. And that puts a point on the chronic underfunding this population sees. At the same time, there is some good news worth talking about. Clarissa estimates there's close to 50 other docs now like her out there trying to improve care. She's created an office at UCSF to share best practices, and she guesses she's trained more than 10,000 providers and caregivers.
Progress, it sounds like, but small scale given the need. Last question, Leslie. We've talked about money a bunch, and that can obviously be a hard thing to squeeze out of lawmakers. Is there anything else other than money that could be done to advance the ball?
Yeah, there actually are a few recent federal rule changes that advocates told me could make a really big difference. The first, which kicked in last year, gives group home residents more of the freedom Kevin has, like setting their own schedules, locking their bedroom doors.
I see. Making these group homes truly feel like home, not just some institution by another name.
Exactly. And you've also got rules expected out this spring that would require any hospital or clinic that gets federal money to add more accessible equipment within 2 years. Think exam tables, scales.
Literally helping people get in the door.
That's right. And that same batch of rules, Dan, bans hospitals from rationing drugs or ventilators purely based on someone's disability, the kind of thing we saw during the pandemic. Finally, there's one bigger change that could force health insurers, at least in theory, to get people like Kevin the stuff they need faster, like speaking valves and wheelchairs.
So these do sound like some meaningful changes. And to close out here, I guess, Leslie, I'd like to circle back to our main character, Clarissa Kripke. I'm wondering, after 2 decades of doing this pioneering work, fighting against all of these policy headwinds that you've outlined, does she feel like she's had the impact she set out to have?
Yeah, I did ask her that, and she said when she looks around, she sees how many people, including her own daughter, still don't have everything they need.
I often feel like I failed. But then when I look back at where we were and where we are now, I realize that we have really made a profound change in how people perceive the goal of healthcare. That healthcare is about helping people to live.
And when she said that, Dan, part of me was like, that's awesome, you know, that she feels she's achieved this kind of change in her community in the San Francisco Bay Area. But then part of me was like, damn, like this is an indictment of how little progress has been made in so many other parts of our healthcare system. Like this primary care doctor has got a dude on a ventilator ringside at a wrestling match. While other clinicians are refusing to even take on these patients, hospitals are denying them organs, and insurers are slow walking the wheelchairs they need.
Right. I mean, it's pretty clear here, Leslie, that healthcare is in this powerful position to do more because the people who have disabilities rely on the healthcare system to help them live their lives as fully as possible.
Yes. I mean, this work from the healthcare system, it absolutely takes time and effort and certainly money, but it's possible. I mean, just like Clarissa said herself, her work proves the healthcare system can help people like Kevin live more the lives they want to live.
Leslie Walker, thanks for your reporting on this story.
You're welcome, Dan.
I'm Dan Gorenstein. This is Trade-Offs.
The If you enjoyed today's episode of Trade-Offs, don't keep it to yourself. Tell someone else about it. Friend, colleague, family member. Better still, leave a rating or a review wherever you subscribe to us. The NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, anywhere. The Trade-Offs team is producers Ryan Levy and Alex Olgan, editors Kate Cahan and Deborah Franklin, executive director Jessica Silverman, marketing director Catherine Dougal, audience engagement lead Shannon Crane, with help from Kate Seepy, Kelly Osmondson, and Cedric Wilson, sound designer Andrew Perella, executive editor Dan Gorenstein, and senior producer Leslie Walker. The Trade-Offs theme song was composed by Ty Sitterman, with additional music this episode from Blue Dot Sessions and Epidemic Sound. Trade-Offs coverage of complex care is supported in part by Arnold Ventures. Additional thanks to Maya Altman, Val Bradley, Michael Chichoko, Melissa Crisp Cooper, Jennifer Drezin, Arturo Guillen, Cheryl Larson, Ari Nayaman, Mary Sowers, and Steve Silkus. Thanks also to all our listeners who helped to support our work, including Vivian Ho, David Spohr, and Farrell Baczynski. Our media partner is Side Effects Public Media, based at WFYI. Trade-Offs is supported by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Arnold Ventures, the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, the Sozose Foundation, Just Trust, West Health, the California Healthcare Foundation, the Leonard Davis Institute at the University of Pennsylvania, and the National Institute for Healthcare Management Foundation. Our financial supporters are not involved in any decisions about our journalism. The views expressed in this episode are those of the individuals and not those of Trade-Offs staff, advisors, or funders.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.